Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Well, welcome back to the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle and KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles. I'm Al Warren. And, of course, joining me for today's interview is Dr. Joe Yasinski. Hey, Joe, how's it going?
Very good. I am enjoying the weather in Miami. I actually spent the weekend in Austin at a political science conference. And the weather was okay there, but it got down to 40. So I actually had to learn what it was like to wear pants.
You don't have to wear pants at 40. It's got to be cooler than that before you take the shorts. That's in my opinion. I'm out there shoveling when it's 30. So, wow. So now today, of course, we're talking a little bit about politics and that area. And we have an author, and he's written the book with a co-author, and Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. And that's Ian Shapiro. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Wow. So that's this is a very appropriate book for the way things are going in not only the States, but the world. What brought you and your co-author to write this book?
Well, we've become increasingly concerned at the dysfunctional and polarized character of politics in not only in the U.S., but many of the established democracies. And we are firmly of the view that part of the problem is a result of a misdiagnosis that's leading to reforms that actually make it worse. And so we really wanted to highlight that phenomenon and try to change the conversation and suggest changes that would move things in a better direction.
What direction are you looking at? Like, are you looking at another country that you think is more successful at their politics?
Well, unfortunately, the sort of problem that has that we're talking about is repeating itself over and over in many different systems. So the British system, for example, used to be much better functioning than ours, but they've made similar reforms. The basic problem is that voters who feel angry and alienated from politics tend to demand reforms that give more direct control to voters over politicians, parties, and decisions. And so you get demands for greater reliance on primaries, you get demands for ballot initiatives and referendums, you get demands for majority-minority districts in the U.S. You get demands for direct election of leaders. But all of these things, what they in fact do is empower unrepresentative groups of voters who are often at the extremes of the political parties, who then make it virtually impossible for them to govern. So just for example, in the U.S., we've had primaries for more than 100 years, but what's changed is that the vast majority of seats in Congress today are safe seats. Maybe 90% of the seats are safe seats, which means that the only election that matters is the primary. And the dirty little secret about primaries is that there's very low turnout. So, for instance, you can have, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez elected in an 11% primary turnout, or you can get somebody like Jim Jordan in Ohio elected in a 15.5% turnout. And the people who turn out tend to be at the extremes of the parties. So when those people then go to Washington, they either compromise, in which case the people who elected them accuse them of selling out, which is accurate, or they don't, in which case we get gridlock, government shutdowns, and everything we're looking at, and other voters become alienated. Either way, the business of politics stops being done, and we get the sort of polarization. This is why polarization in Congress is more extreme than polarization in the population, and it's why it's so difficult for the parties to govern.
So, one question I have is this sort of an elitist take that you're taking here? You're saying we should have less participation. Do you want to get rid of primaries? Should we get rid of elections altogether? I mean, because if the problem is the primary, wouldn't the problem also manifest itself in the general election too? That you still have voters who aren't that educated, and many of whom are polarized.
No, I don't think it's a lack of education, and I don't think voters are stupid. We also don't think politicians are evil. We tend to shoot the messengers, but the politicians are responding to the incentives in front of them. It's not an elitist take. We think the best metaphor for thinking about parties is sports teams. So if you think about a football, an NFL team, you know, there's huge authority is delegated to the quarterbacks and the managers, but they have enough rope to hang themselves. If they don't deliver victories, they're gone pretty soon. What we have done is so weakened political parties that the people running them can't deliver for the reasons I've said, but actually the backbenchers or the representatives can't even coordinate enough to remove them. So, you know, we saw Nancy Pelosi led the Democrats to 4 successive defeats, and she was still there. Or if you look on the Republican side, you know, the Freedom Caucus, who were the Tea Party people, felt completely betrayed by John Boehner, but they couldn't actually get him out. They couldn't coordinate among the disparate Republican groups to get him out. And the same thing happened with Paul Ryan. So we have protected but ineffective leadership and parties that can't function. So we're not for going back to smoke-filled rooms, but if you think about giving the party leadership a greater say in the selection of candidates, at least when there's very low turnout, you would get a different result, because they have an incentive to pick people who can both win in their district and support a national program that everybody in the party can get behind. So the sorts of reforms we're proposing are things like, if the turnout in a primary falls below some threshold, say 75% of the turnout in the previous general election, then the congressional party leadership would be able to pick the candidate. Likewise, in presidential elections, Donald Trump was picked by less than 5% of the U.S. electorate as the Republican candidate, and the Republicans couldn't stop him because, unlike the Democrats to that point, the superdelegates were bound by the primary results on the first ballot. We're not, you know, we think superdelegates are a band-aid on a bad system, and we're not for going back to smoke-filled rooms and all of that. But it's worth remembering that until 1828, the congressional parties picked the presidential candidates. It was when Andrew Jackson lost to John Quincy Adams in 1824, he mounted the first populist assault on the system, and that's why we got our first national conventions in 1828 when he won. But if you have the congressional leadership having a bigger say in the choice of presidential candidates, it would make the U.S. system function more like a parliamentary system, and the president and the congressional parties would be cooperating much better than they managed to do under the present system.
So I do like your solution, and I do like the idea that if you have a primary where you have almost nobody showing up, that you would avoid that result, because I think we do get some strange, you know, candidates because of that, and I think you bring up Cortez, and that's probably a good example. And she probably
and
doesn't
Caucuses
match.
Are even worse. Yeah.
Yeah. She
way,
probably
Caucuses
doesn't.
Are even worse. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she's a you know, a socialist. She probably does not represent the majority of her district, and she may very well be there for 40 or 50 years if she wanted to be, because once she gets ingrained, she'll have her incumbent. And, you know, her incumbency to keep her there. But I one thing I want to get back to is, I mean, it is, I agree with you that there are some places where we should limit popular control and allow the parties a little more. But on the one hand, I mean, we do sort of have that a lot now. I mean, if you pick out, you know, some primaries where nobody shows up, yes, that makes sense. And the election of Donald Trump, yes, that makes sense. But you know, both you and I are familiar with works, you know, for example, the book The Party Decides, that shows that, yeah, you have these people voting in primaries, but it's really elites that are, you know, donating the money, bringing the candidates into their networks, and doing the endorsements that really decide the primary behind the scenes. And what happened with Trump seems to be an exception rather than the rule. So
actually we disagree with that. If you look at the data, I mean, the Democratic Party tried to stop Obama getting the nomination in favor of Hillary, and they were not able to do it. The Republican Party tried to stop there was a lot of resistance to John McCain. If you actually go through election by election, it seems like the folks who wrote that book actually just got it plain wrong. Rick Peldis at NYU Law School has gone through, you know, dozens of elections and finds the data just doesn't support that. The parties are now too weak. They used to decide, but they're just too weak to stop the possibility of essentially hostile takeovers. And you know, they almost the Democrats tried to. You know, almost weren't able to stop Bernie Sanders. And indeed, the condition of getting him to support Hillary's ticket in 2016 was that they have now changed their rules so that the primary voters will prevail on the first ballot. Not that that stopped Hillary from winning this time, but so they would not be able to stop a Trump-like figure next time.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with that, because it did look like the Republicans were sort of impotent in dealing with the Trump issue.
Absolutely.
And it seemed sort of ridiculous. I understand why they wanted to appear more egalitarian, but the Democrats, by getting rid of the superdelegate issue, seems to be a backward move.
Absolutely.
So on one area, I want to push you on a little bit. So even if parties do become more powerful and perhaps can govern better because of it, you still have democracy there. You're still going to have people voting, at least in general elections.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of studies on this that say people aren't that well informed. They don't know about most of the policies. And if you look at presidential elections, They tend to vote based on economic performance in the last two quarters rather than the whole breadth of the work that the president's done over the 4 years. So it just sort of seems like people are going to vote for one, you know, the party they belong to, and then that will be tempered somewhat by, you know, recent economic performance. And economic performance is going to go up and down. It doesn't really reflect that much on the president. So isn't there still a problem with democracy that we have to solve?
So I'd say, you know, I agree with you up to a point, but only up to a point. And we the spirit of our book, Responsible Parties Saving Democracy from Itself, is very much not, well, if we can't solve every problem, we mustn't solve any problem. We're trying to push in the other direction. And what I would say about voter ignorance is we shouldn't blame the voters. It's so easy to blame the voters. But part of the reason voters don't take an interest in what the candidates say is because of what the candidates are saying. The candidates are largely catering to the extremes of the parties, and they're not talking about the sorts of issues that matter most to most voters. And so the voters don't have that much of an incentive. So one of the reasons there's low turnout in general elections is because of the kind of people who get picked in the primaries. And then, you know, voters take a look at the candidates and it's the, you know, lesser of two evils, and they really have no incentive, to learn about what the candidates are proposing. Another reform we're suggesting would get more candidates that are like the voters, more like the median voter in the district. So if you look at plans to redistrict, you know, in a lot of states they're determined by the whoever controls the state legislature. But then if it's all controlled by one party, they just make safe seats for themselves.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Reproducing the problem. Or sometimes when there's divided party control in the state legislature, they do bipartisan gerrymandering. They just carve up the state into state safe seats, which is also bad. So we really like the move to independent commissions that you see in a number of the states, California being one, for example. But the trouble with the move is often they're not really independent. They're bipartisan, so they just make deals. Or they haven't been given the right thing to maximize, because what they should be maximizing is the competitiveness of the the districts between the parties. Ideally, districts should have both rural voters in them and urban voters, rather than, you know, blue cities and red states, where, again, you get these safe seats that are decided in the primaries. And the general election voters look at, you know, the things that these candidates are running on and promising to their grassroots, and they're not interested. So I'm reluctant to blame the voter.
Okay. So let me ask another question. So when you say responsible parties, have some solutions for our current parties to come in and fix things. How about third parties? Would you think that would be, could those solve some problems? I mean, we have the Green Party and we have a Libertarian Party, which are tiny, but do have some organization across the different states. Would you recommend them becoming more powerful, or does your book sort of push the position that having two is fine?
So we think not, because, you know, people like to think the grass is always greener somewhere else. But in our book, we have chapters on France, Germany, Britain, Eastern Europe, and Latin America, and we look at all different kinds of electoral systems. And the problem with multi-party systems is they undermine accountability in a different way, because you always have to have coalition governments. No, nobody wins a majority. And once you have coalition governments, the different parties can blame one another for what actually happens in government. We think the most important thing is for governments to be held accountable by voters for what they actually do. So parties should run on a platform, and the voters should know that if they win, this is what will be implemented. And then they can make a retrospective judgment afterwards. Well, did they do what they said they were going to do? Did they get it right? Or not. Whereas once you have multi-party systems, you don't get that. And furthermore, if you look at the European multi-party systems, even the ones that used to be very functional, like Germany or Holland, the parties are now fragmenting, partly because of the collapse of organized labor, which has led to splintering parties on the left, and that then produces splintering on the right. So it's now routine for you know, even in Germany, which was held out as the best of those systems, it took Merkel, you know, 8 months to form a coalition, and both members of it are deeply unpopular. They are now losing to the far-right extreme parties and to the Greens in regional elections. So we don't think, you know, we think in whatever system you have, we should be moving towards fewer parties rather than more, and stronger parties rather than weak, so that what you actually get is accountable governments. Because at the end of the day, it's what the government does or doesn't do that is really most consequential for the voters.
I was going to say...
So where do you see...
On the European notion in Britain and that, did you ever look at the Canadian parliamentary system? And... Now... Comparatively, because the prime minister is just one vote and part of the party, and because you do have coalition governments, and even in Britain, when something does go wrong, the government can't put forth something that doesn't pass, or there's a non-confidence. Mm-hmm. So in a way, they are paying for it if they can't get their act together and put in a law that's going to pass, whereas in the U.S., that doesn't happen.
Yeah, so, you know, the basics of the political science on this are that if you have single-member district systems like we have and the British have and the Canadians have, you'll tend to get two parties, provided the median voter in the district is pretty much like the median voter in the country. The districts have to more or less reflect the country. Now, Canada has regional variation, that's why you get the Quebecois. Or in India, where there's a lot of regional variation, even though they have single-member districts, they get more parties. The answer to that, and in Britain, of course, they have some regional variation too, so you get the Scottish Nationalists, and you get nationalist parties in Ireland. So that undermines the two-party dimension. But for the most part in Britain, they tend to get two parties. It would be a little better if they had bigger constituencies, because the problem in Britain is that London is so wealthy and the rest of the country is so poor by comparison. And so, what would be perfect in Britain is if a sliver of London was in every constituency. Obviously, you can't go that far, but they have very small constituencies by world standards. So they could, reduce the House of Commons to 400 people and have bigger constituencies, and they would be ahead. But they have made many of the same mistakes we've made. They didn't have to have a referendum on Brexit. You know, that really sharpens what we're talking about, because what parties do is they bundle issues. So if you think about it, if you ask American voters, would you like a tax cut? Overwhelmingly, they'll say yes, even if it's the estate tax that almost nobody pays. But if you say, would you like a tax cut if it meant getting rid of prescription drug benefits for seniors? They'll say no. So in the second case, what they're doing is bundling. They are discounting their preference for the tax cut by their preference for the prescription drug benefits. That's what parties do. They discount everything they propose by everything else they propose. And if you pull out something like Brexit, people can just vote on that preference. The reason most voters will say yes to Brexit but will also elect two parties that are overwhelmingly against Brexit is that the parties in Parliament know that if they bundle Brexit with all the other things that their supporters care about, it's going to produce bad outcomes for their supporters. It's just like, in California, we had Proposition 13, limiting property taxes. Everyone says, great. But then, that's not being bundled with what effect that's going to have on the school system and local government services and so on. So, again, it seems more democratic, but actually all it does is make it impossible for governments to do what they should do, and for parties to bundle issues in ways that are responsible, in that they can actually deliver for voters the benefits that voters need.
So one thing that happens when you have cohesive parties is that you can also get a situation where, like the Republican Party now is going to support Trump, it seems like, no matter what, right? They will pay a price in 2 years if they don't support him, and he will, he seems like he wants to make sure that they do. So there's a negative side to this too. There could be a very dark side to having these groups that are going to stick up for each other, even when you have people engaging in misbehavior.
That's exactly right. But it's the illusion that the party is strong. The reason they're all terrified of Trump is because the party is weak. So if you look at Mitch McConnell, why will he not have a vote, a straight up vote on opening the government, even though he knows there's considerable support for that in the Senate? It's because he's looking at a primary challenge in Kentucky, and he knows that the Tea Party people will go after him and Trump will encourage him if he does that. So he's actually in a very weak position. He's not in a strong position. It's just the parties look cohesive, but in fact they've been subject to a hostile takeover, and they're being controlled by a fringe group. So unless you tackle that phenomenon, you're not going to change anything else, because it's not that Mitch McConnell is an evil person. It's that Mitch McConnell doesn't want to go the way that Eric Cantor went. He simply cannot take on the far right of the Republican Party, the Freedom Caucus and the Tea Party people, and expect to survive. So unless we change the rules that make somebody like him that vulnerable, they're not going to do it because they won't survive. And you'll either have gridlock or like, first Boehner and then Ryan, they'll just give up and go away.
Let me suggest one other solution to you that you may or may not have considered, is that maybe a Mitch McConnell, maybe he doesn't have to hold a seat in the Senate. Maybe the House and the Senate should pick leaders for themselves that, do you think that could solve some of the problem?
Pick leaders for themselves that what?
that don't hold the seat. So, for example, they wouldn't have to worry about they won't be able to vote, but they don't have to worry about being voted for in a particular state or district.
Well, it's an interesting idea. I worry that that's the beginning of the slippery slope back to smoke-filled rooms and party grandees and others. I really think the football metaphor is or any sport metaphor is what you really want is that everybody should be on the same team so that the same strategy will, as much as possible, be the best for them. So, you know, the party leadership, as I said, if they have a big say in picking candidates, are going to pick people who can both win in their districts and be on the same team nationally. That's what they're going to be trying to maximize, those two things. Of course, it's hard because of regional variation, and it would be helped along if we had independent commissions drawing districts and we made primaries less important in the ways I've suggested and so on. It's still always hard. But that would make the biggest difference, we think.
What about the Electoral College? What's your thoughts?
So everybody says, oh, we should get rid of the Electoral College. You know, it's so unfair. Hillary got 3 million more votes, and she didn't get elected president. We actually think it's a sideshow, because if you strengthen the president, which is what you would do if you got rid of the Electoral College, the president would have more legitimacy, not less. That would just further weaken the party leaderships in Congress, and the U.S. would start to look more like Latin America. And those systems are very unstable and invite so much populism precisely because the president has an independent, an independent constituency being directly elected by the voters and can therefore ignore the legislature or force or threaten the legislature. We want to make the president more like a prime minister, more dependent on Congress. So this whole debate about getting rid of the Electoral College seems to us to be just beside the point.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting.
And, you know, as I said, I think I said earlier, this used to be the system until 1828. All the reforms we propose in our book, Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself, could be done without constitutional amendments and so on. You know, they're all within the realm of things that actually could happen.
Now, do you think people are going to adopt this idea?
I think that we're hoping it's an idea whose time is coming. You know, we realize we're in some sense swimming upstream because people think, no, what we need is more direct control, not less. But all they get is the illusion of control. They don't actually get control. And what they really need is accountable government. One thing that I think it has going for it is that we haven't talked about the role of money in politics, and everybody talks about the supply of money to politics and all of the lobbyists and fat cats who give money. But we look at it from the demand side. Why do politicians need so much money? And it's because they need money to engage in these perpetual campaigns, which are made so much worse by primaries. That's one thing the British system is much better at. They have very short, cheap campaigns. And so if the politicians didn't need all this money, they hate raising this money. They hate spending the time. They hate being beholden to the lobbyists. And, you know, the sort of reforms that we are suggesting would make it much less necessary, because if every politician in Congress is basically on their own, they all need this money in order to survive. Wholesale campaigning is much cheaper than retail campaigning. If they were all basically on the same team, they wouldn't need all of this money. So we think that politicians should find our ideas appealing, if not for any other reason, just for that reason.
Well, Ian, thank you very much for being on the show. Our guest has been Ian Shapiro. The book is Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. We'll have that linked up to our site. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks so much for having me on.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.